Thank you all for that good singing, our great pianist who really makes that piano sing, that lovely song. I think that Steve Green, the man who sings that song, is one of the finest artists today, and his songs, his music, I can just play his tapes over and over. Such good words, and that particular song she sung is one of my favorites, Precious Lamb of Glory. Why, it just causes goosebumps to go all over my arms. We're looking now at the second in a series of messages entitled The Greatness of the Great Commission. And I have four very simple points this evening, but let's turn to our text in Matthew chapter 28. Matthew 28. The Greatness of the Great Commission. The Great Commission is found in all four Gospels, and it's found in the book of Acts. Chapter 1, verse 8. But you know, there's even a greater commission than the Great Commission. And that's the commission given in heaven from the Father to the Son. We see it in Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, when the Father, in the fullness of time, sent forth the Son. And the Son came here to rescue the lost sons and daughters of Adam. But this is our commission. 4 points. The greatness of the author, the greatness of his claims, the greatness of the commission, and the greatness of the extent of the commission. We'll go over those very simply for those of you who do not have photographic memories and have missed most of that. For those of you who are sleeping, wake up. Number one, the greatness of the author. Matthew chapter 28, verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee, into a mountain where Jesus had appointed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spoke unto them, saying, all authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth. The greatness of the author, the commander in chief, is giving us our marching orders in his absence. Now, I'd like you to notice the first thing here is that he is worshipped. Now, these are Jews. Jews do not worship people. Now, you know, here in America, we're just so silly. The Guru Maharaji comes along and everyone bows down and worships, and they give him all these Rolls Royces, and we'll just worship anyone or anything. Doesn't make any difference. But these are Jews. These are people steeped in the tradition that they worship only Jehovah God. And yet these Jews worship Jesus Christ. Someone has said that if William Shakespeare was to walk into this room, we would all stand to our feet. But if Jesus Christ was to walk into this room, we would fall on our knees. He is worshipped. And the reason he is worshipped is that he is God. The greatness of the author. Listen to what someone has read about this great written about this great commission. If the first part of the Great Commission represents the greatest claim ever made, all authority, and the second part of it represents the greatest command ever given, go into all the world, then we may be in order to call the third part the greatest promise ever made. I am with you to the end of the age. Only God could promise such a thing. Everything about this commission is great. Everything about this commission is unique because of the one giving it and the promises that entail this commission. Now, number two, the greatness of his claims. Notice what he claims. They worshipped him, and Jesus came and spoke unto them, saying, all authority is given unto me in heaven and earth. Jesus claims omnipotence and universal and unrestricted sovereignty. The royal sovereign is speaking, and all of heaven is behind him. Now, can you imagine, and I hear there are some major changes in the Soviet Union right now, if Mr. Boris Yeltsin comes out of this a great hero, and he stands before the world, and he says, all authority in heaven, all authority on earth, all authority in every nation has been given to me. But we say something must have gone wrong up here in those few days that he was incarcerated. He wouldn't say such a thing. No one would ever say such a thing. All authority in heaven, all authority on earth, it's been given to me. Now you go to all the nations. That's the greatness of his claim. And it's the claim that will give us the groundwork for the command, go to all nations and make disciples of all nations. Now, number three, the greatness of the commission. Well, it is a divine commission. It's a biblical commission. It's a prophetic prophecy. Let's turn to Luke 24. Don had referred to this earlier. Luke gives us his rendition of the Great Commission, and it adds some very wonderful notes that will help us understand the greatness of the commission. The divine imperative. Luke 24:44. And he said unto them, verse 44, these are the words which I spoke unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning me. And this is what I want to emphasize. Verse 46. And said unto them, thus it is written. Will you please note that? Thus it is written, and thus it behooveth Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead the third day. Don't stop here. Don't have your verse division here. And that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name among all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. Verse 46 and 47 should be connected. Now, every single one of you would agree that the prophets of old, that the Old Testament prophesies that Christ should suffer. Do you all agree with that? Is there anyone here that would disagree with that? That the Old Testament predicted his suffering. You would all take me to Isaiah 53, wouldn't you? Or you would take me to Psalm 22, wouldn't you? I hope you would. And you would agree that the Old Testament predicted he would rise again from the dead, wouldn't you? Yes, you would. But how many of here would tell me that the Old Testament predicted that it should be proclaimed to the nations? That's what this verse is telling us. Our Lord is saying it is written that he should suffer, he should rise again the third day, and that his repentance should be proclaimed to the nations. But where is that in the Old Testament? Well, it's in a number of places. Let's look at one of the key verses that he may be thinking of as he gives this. Look at Isaiah 49. Isaiah 49. Isaiah 49 begins a whole series of the servant of the Lord passages. They're all the way from Isaiah 49 to Isaiah 57. A whole series of passages that refer to the great servant of the Lord. They're called servant of the Lord passages. But in this one, Isaiah 49 verse 6, we see the prophecy of his proclamation of his work to the nations. Verse 6, this is a very important verse. This verse is quoted in Acts chapter 13, I think verse 47. Paul quotes this. And he said, it is a light thing, or if you like, it's a small thing, that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. In other words, it's really a small thing, a limited thing, that you should raise up Jacob. I will also give thee, the servant of the Lord, Messiah, for a light to the nations, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. This prophecy is saying that it's a small thing, it's too little of a thing for Christ simply to be connected to Israel. But God will give him as salvation to all the nations. It's a prophetic statement about the proclamation of the salvation he accomplished on the cross. Now you can go right back to the beginning of the Bible. Right back to Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. You can go back to Genesis 22, verse 8, particularly in the Greek Septuagint text. And we are promised that through the covenant of Abraham, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And today we're a blessed people. We're Gentiles saved out of this world. Part of that great covenant promise that God would reach out to the nations and salvation would be for all the nations. My brothers and sisters, the Great Commission is a prophetic command. It goes right back into your Old Testament. Romans chapter 16. Let's just look at that for a moment. A verse we don't look at very often, but also teaching that the Great Commission is a command from God, a divine imperative. Romans 16, verse 25 and 26. But let's just pick it up at verse 26. Verse 26, and now is made manifest and by the scriptures of the prophets according to the commandment of the everlasting God made known to all nations for the obedience of faith. Let me give a little modern rendition that might just tighten that up. The eternal God has commanded that all nations should know the truth. That's a little loose, but it captures the idea. The eternal God has commanded that all nations should know the truth. Eric Sauer wrote these words, "Missions work is a divine must." We could say a prophetic must. "Remissions of sin should and must be preached in His name among all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. It is not left to our own choice whether or not we will testify to the world of the message of the cross." We have the most wonderful message in the world. There's no message like it. Now, what if we had the cure for cancer? What would you think if I was a scientist and I had the cure for cancer, but I really didn't want to tell everyone? What would you think of me? For we have the cure for the worst kind of cancer, soul cancer, which has eternal consequences. It's the cause of all causes of all our problems here on the planet. You're never going to hear Mr. Bush say this. Our Congress, our Senate won't tell you this. They will not tell you. Time Magazine, Newsweek will not tell you the cause of all our problems. Oh, they might say it's educational. They might say it's society. They might say it's a lack of this or that, economic problems. But the cause of all our ills is sin. And Jesus Christ came to deal with the fundamental human problem, sin. And no one else can deal with it. There's no other cure but the blood of Jesus Christ. There is no other. And guess what? We happen to know that. What a responsibility is ours. You know, we're involved in the most important mission on this planet. Again, it will not be in our newspapers, it will not be in our magazines, but God is doing something. When you look at the sinfulness of this world, you wonder why God lets it go on another minute. Martin Luther, looking at the sin in his own day, said, God ought to just kick the whole thing to pieces. And He ought to. Except for the body He's building. Except for that family He's uniting. He just kick it all to pieces. But He has a work to do on this earth. A rescue work. And there in Africa, and there in China, and there in India, and South America, and Central America, all over this planet, He is adding members to the body. He is building a holy temple, a holy house, a holy body to Himself, a body that will last and live with Him forever. The results of the wonderful work of His Son, the most important thing in His mind, His Son, and what His Son has done, and the product of His Son's work. You as a Christian, you are involved in the most important activity on this earth. Not democracy and communism. It's not Wall Street. It's not the Dow Jones average. It's not the economy. It is the building of Christ's body. The building of the church. That is the most important thing. And you are involved in it. You won't be written up in the newspaper. They won't tell you about the soul saved in Africa. But it's all recorded in heaven very carefully, and not one will ever be missed or lost. One writer has written this, "Despite some sleeping churches, nothing in the world today is growing more dramatically than the Christian movement. What China has to fear today is Christianity." The statistics are almost staggering. In the last 40 years, the statistics are telling us there's somewhere between 35 million to 50 million Chinese who have come to Christ. The most formidable enemy of communism today. Despite all this opposition, all of the problems, the Church of Jesus Christ is growing there in China. And someday, at the Bema Seat of Christ, we're going to see millions and millions of Chinese. And we're going to hear stories, and we're going to see the great power of God that has been operating on this earth. Although the world does not acknowledge it, it'll all be knowledge someday, and it's all going to be open before all to see, and we're going to see again, He has been victorious. He has won a people to Himself. You're involved in that big movement. You're important in God's movement. Your prayers, your giving, your service. I wouldn't want to be involved in anything else. I wouldn't want to be building the biggest company in America. Probably next year we'll find out it's the smallest company. I'm involved in the most important thing. And you young people here, don't give your life to small things. Give it to big things. Building of His body. Do we have a great commission? We have a great commission. Now, number four. The greatness of the extent of the commission. What is the extent of this commission? The key word is all. All nations. Make disciples of all nations. Now, Friday night I'll talk about make disciples and baptize and teach. But I'm not interested in that this evening. I'm interested in the extent of our mandate. Disciple all nations. I like what Broadus in his commentary says. Listen carefully to this. Christianity is essentially a missionary religion. It is not like Judaism. In Judaism, they do not reach out to people. Christianity, to be Christianity, is something that is propagated and spoken of and announced and heralded to the world. David Livingstone, the great missionary to Africa, said, God had only one son. He was a missionary and a physician. When we look at the book of Acts, what do we see in the book of Acts? All nations. That's what we see there. Starting in Jerusalem, all the way to Rome. God doing His work. Leonard Capelt, the German theologian, writes this. According to Acts, from the earliest beginnings of the church's missionary work was the most important expression of life in the congregation of the risen Lord. And then Michael Green, in his classic work, Evangelism in the Early Church, writes this. The enthusiasm to evangelize which marked the early Christians is one of the most remarkable things in the history of religions. Here were men and women of every rank and station of life, of every country of the known world, so convinced that they had discovered the riddle of the universe, so sure of the one true God whom they had come to know, that nothing must stand in the way of their passing on the good news to others. We're a people with a commission. We're a people with a mandate. We're a people with a purpose. Get up and get going. We either keep the Great Commission or we go out of commission. It's that simple. We have a great commission before us. In Acts 17, verse 6, the mob said of the Thessalonians, these men who have come have upset the whole world. In just a short time, they were upsetting the whole world. And I think of Romans 10:15. How beautiful are the feet of those who bring glad tidings, good news. How beautiful are the feet of those. You have beautiful feet? Do you sense the commission? Do you sense a mandate over you? Are you involved? I heard some statistics, and of course, statistics are good to get general ideas. You can't take them too seriously. But I heard that someone has recorded that it takes at least 35 people to get one person saved. And I just sort of get the essence of it. We send a missionary out. The missionary goes out and leads someone to Christ. But he's not alone. First of all, there are people who trained the missionary, people who led the missionary to Christ. There are people who financially supported the missionary. There are people praying. There are people supporting out on the field. Maybe there's a wife and children. There's others around. So that one missionary is there, but he's really surrounded by a network of people upholding him. Beyond the Ranges, that great book about Fraser's work among the Lisu people, which of course, as you know today, thousands of the Lisu people have been saved. beyond the ranges. But the point was that while he was there for 10 years, nothing happened among the Lisu people. Back in England, there were churches laboring in prayer for the Lisu people. And finally, the breakthrough came through. We're all involved in some way. Even though I am not on the mission field, I must be involved on all nations. I'm consciously aware. We'll talk about how to do that in a moment. I want to just add one point here. God has always been concerned about the nations. The Great Commission is reach all nations, disciple all nations, but he's always been concerned about the nations all through the Bible. Go back to the beginning of the Bible and Noah. The Bible says in 2 Peter 2:5 that he was a preacher of righteousness. What a poor man he was. He preached 120 years, didn't see one convert. I once read an article that said, can 50 million Americans be wrong? Of course 50 million Americans can be wrong. The whole world was wrong. Noah made people enter the ark. The whole world went down. But he was a preacher of righteousness. And he was there as God's witness to the nations. Lot, who we see as a carnal man, but in 2 Peter 2:7, he was a witness of God in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. They didn't like him for it. And Abraham, the great patriarch, was a witness of the true God to the heathen nations. God was so merciful to them, he waited 450 years after he spoke to Abraham until their sins and iniquities filled up. He finally brought the children of Israel in to destroy them. But he had been patient with them. He's always had a witness. Genesis 12:8 says that Bethel, Abraham, built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Luther translates that, proclaim the name of the Lord. His point being that Abraham, this great man of God, this Bedouin in our concept, was really a witness there, a blessed man of God, so people could know of the Lord. Melchizedek. Out of nowhere this man comes, king of Salem, king of Jerusalem, priest of the Most High God. He blesses Abraham. Where in the world does this man come from? Well, one thing we learn is God has always had his witness. He's always had a witness. No one will stand before God and say, well, I never knew. Well, he has the stars, he has the moon, he has the creation, he has conscience within us. But he's had people down through the ages. I think of Jonah. Think of that great book in the Old Testament. God sent Jonah not to Jerusalem. He sent Jonah to where? Nineveh, a pagan, heathen city. Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city. Cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. Jonah got a little rebellious about the whole thing. Listen to what God says to Jonah at the end of the book. And should I not have compassion on Nineveh? Why would God even care? Old pagan, dark city? No, he's a God of compassion. Shall I not have compassion on Nineveh, the great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know the difference between their right hand and their left hand, as well as many animals? I think of Daniel. Why, what a man Daniel was. He's in the courts of some of the world's greatest emperors and rulers. God has always had his witness. Key man in the right spot. Daniel stood in the courts of Nebuchadnezzar, who seems to later have believed, Darius and Cyrus. Daniel 5:21. He tells Belshazzar, the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomsoever he wishes. Think of men like Nehemiah in Artaxerxes' court among the Persians. There in the top position, God has had a witness to the nations of his name. But of all the witnesses in the Old Testament, the greatest was Israel. Israel was to be a witness to the nations. Listen to Isaiah 43:10. God says of Israel, you are my witnesses, declare the Lord. And that's in the context of God speaking of the nations and their idolatry. He says, you, Israel, you are my witness. God's plan in the Old Testament was to raise up the nation of Israel to be a light to the nations and a witness to the nations. Listen to what Solomon says. He has this concept in mind. This is from 2 Chronicles 6:32 and 33. Solomon says, also concerning the foreigner who is not from thy people Israel, when he comes from a far country, for thy great name's sake, and thy mighty hand, and thine outstretched arm, when they come. Now notice, in the Old Testament they come, in the New Testament we go. When they come and pray towards this house, then thou shalt hear from heaven, from thy dwelling place, and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to thee. Brothers and sisters, listen. In order that all the peoples of the earth may know thy name and fear thee as they do thy people Israel. That all the nations may know thee and fear thee. Now don't turn to this right now, but write these verses down because they're really very interesting. Exodus 23, verse 25 and 26. God's plan for Israel. God had promised Israel, if you'll obey me, five things in these verses. No sickness, no lack of food, no miscarriages, long life, some of you already got that promise, and deliverance from foreign enemies. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 6 to 8, Israel was to be a wise and just nation among all the nations of the world. Their rules and their laws would be unlike any other nation. And then in Deuteronomy 15:6, we read, you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow, and you will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. Here's God's plan of witness in the Old Testament. God said to Israel, if you obey me, I will bless you beyond any nation in the world. Why, you'll have prosperity. You'll have a bumper crop every year. You'll have plenty of rain. You'll have many, many children. Why, you'll have longevity. You'll have no enemies over you, no sickness. Can you imagine being down in Egypt and you read the Egyptian Gazette and the Egyptian Gazette says the people in Israel have no hospitals. All those good Jewish doctors put them out of business. You know all those terrible Medicare and Medicare forms? None of those. Don't you like to destroy all those? None of that. There's no sickness there. Why, everyone in the world be talking about it. What a place. And you know, our scientists have been studying these people. They live. Some of them live to be, 86 and 96 and 106. They live to be old. And nothing but prosperity. And the nations would come and they would learn of God's house and God's law and God's priests. Listen to what Solomon said, 2 Chronicles 9, 22, 23. So King Solomon, or this is what happened to King Solomon, so King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And all, get the word all, and all the kings of the earth were seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom which God had put in his heart. That was God's plan. The nations would come to a place, and at that place, they would learn of the true and living God. That's God's plan of witness in the Old Testament. Israel was to be a separate people. Israel was to be a holy nation. In Peter now, we're studying all these terms in the second chapter. They all refer to Israel at one time. They were to be a priestly people. They were to be a light. They were to rebuke the nations. The nations were to know of God. They were to have God's sanctuary, God's presence, God's priest, God's law. But Israel failed. And you know how Israel failed? Israel didn't want to be the unique people of God. They wanted to be like the other nations. God gave them all these things, and yet they couldn't get over the Baals and the Asherim, and they wanted kings like the other nations. They wanted to be like the other nations. And when they compromised with the other nations, they lost their witness. They lost the blessing. And they were not the people that God promised them they could be and the witness they could be. You know, there's a solemn, solemn warning here. God has called us to be unique people, holy people, separate people. But in many ways, the Church of Jesus Christ has lost its witness. Listen to what the great Martin Lloyd-Jones says. The glory of the gospel is that when the church is absolutely different from the world, she inevitably attracts it. It is then that the world is made to listen to her message, though it may hate it at first. That is how revival comes. That must also be true of us as individuals. It should not be our ambition to be as much like everyone else as we can, though we happen to be Christians, but rather to be as different from everyone who is not a Christian as we can possibly be. Our ambition should be to be like Christ. The more like Him, the better. The more like Him we become, the more we should be unlike anybody else who is not a Christian. The uniqueness of the church is to be that holy people of God. But just like Israel went after the idols and the Baals, we have our idols. Colossians 2:5. Consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passions, evil desires, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. None of us here are going to get drunk and fall before wooden idols. We're not going to do that. But we become drunk and intoxicated, and we fall before the idols of this world, materialism and reputation and success and all the things the world puts before us, and we just love the world. We have our veneer of Christianity, our Sunday morning Christianity, but basically we pursue the world all week. There's very little in the way of real sacrifice or real difference than this world. We have done the same thing Israel has done. We have become like those we are to witness to. And then there's a second problem. Not only is our worldliness and idolatry, but human selfishness. I don't want to take more time on this because I want to move to some practical things. We could talk about this another time. But I believe selfishness is the great enemy of the gospel, which is plain, ordinary selfish. We don't want to make the effort. We don't want to make the sacrifice. We're so self-consumed. We won't even hand out a tract, or we won't even just speak to someone. And you know, the more we become like the world, the more we cater to the world, the more ashamed of the gospel we become. And Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. It's a serious thing to be ashamed of the gospel. Frightened that people might think we're cultists, or frightened that people might take us wrong, and just always so paranoid of what other people are going to think of us. We just can't open our mouths, afraid to be rejected or laughed at, worrying too much about people. This is the great mandate that is before us. All nations, disciple all nations. What a vision. We have been given a world vision. Let's talk about some practical ways we can implement some of this material we've looked at. Some practical ideas. How can we get that world vision? How can we get that great commission, that great mandate fixed before us so that we see the great work that God has given to us? Our sovereign commander is left behind for us. What a great command is ours. Four things. Number one, be informed. Be informed. A Christian is to have world vision, a world mandate. You can't do that without information. I think the news is very important to us. I was in a meeting about 4 years ago, and there was this man. He was only about 35 years of age, and he was complaining. I don't want to look at the news. I don't want to read the newspaper. I don't even want to know what's going on out there. That fellow doesn't know anything about the great commission given to us. Our great mandate from our great commander-in-chief. If anybody is interested in what is going on in the world, it's us as Christians. Because everything that goes on in the news affects the gospel some way. And I want to know what's going on in every country in the world right now. Because it affects the gospel. That's how I look at the news. Every morning when I get up in the morning, the radio goes on. That's how I get up. And I listen to National Public News. Now, if you think it's real liberal and all that, that's fine. I'm sure it has lots of bad perspectives, but you've got to get the news from someone. And so for a full hour every morning, when I get up in the morning, I listen to National Public Radio. One thing I do like about National Public Radio is that it's much more in-depth, and they'll focus in on parts of the world where the normal national news, it is so myopic, and it's just, oh, you go crazy. You don't even think anything else in the world exists out there. But national news will focus all over the world, and they'll give you a 4 or 5, 6 minute report on different parts of the world. So I start every morning with National Public News. And I want to hear what's going on because I am concerned about the gospel. I am concerned because I've been given a mandate. It's worldwide. So I better know what's going on in the world and how it's going to affect my mandate and my commission. You know, we should listen to the news totally different. You know, when there was a war between the Allies and the Iraq, so many people are saying, go in there, bomb those guys, kill those guys. That's not the way the Christian looks at it. Our whole concern is, how is all this going to affect getting the gospel into that needy country of Iraq? That's our concern. I don't care if they blow this one up and that one. Well, we've got F-11 stealth fighters. Man, did you see how they blew up all those people? And we're all concerned about our American pride. You're proud about all these things this country does? Our concern as we listen to the news is, how will the gospel be affected? You know, some of us actually get mad at the poor Muslim people, and we're angry. Good, go in there and kill them all. No, no, they're lost sinners. What would you be like if you were born over there, huh? See the American perspective from their vantage point? The limited information that's been given to those people, they've basically been manipulated all their lives by tyrants and bullies and men who have just done nothing, killed one another. What else can they see? Let's have Christ's compassion for them. Let's see the news through the Great Commission. One of my dear friends, a man I've known for over 20 years, is a missionary in Amman, Jordan. He wrote me a really great letter. He said, Alex, we have complete and total access into Iraq today. We're going in with food and Bibles. And one of the bishops of Iraq said, the thing that Iraqis need more than anything else is the Bible. And right now, there are Jordanian Christians taking the gospel into Iraq, and they have complete open doors because of their political situation with Iraq today. Now, that's what we should be concerned about as Christians. That the Son of God, that great work on the cross, gets into Iraq and reaches Iraqis. In Iran today, we have a brother right in our assemblies, Dick Papworth, in that radio voice of Christ that's going into Iran. Iran is ripe for the gospel today. Most people, 90% of the population does not like the Revolutionary Guard. They've destroyed that country. And there are serious questions about Islam among people there. There is an openness of the gospel that hasn't been there. We've seen world news that it will affect people so that people will hear Jesus Christ. I don't have the American perspective on news. I have the God perspective on news. And we start siding with heathen nations who are all basically selfish and doing their own thing. You need to listen to the news. You need magazines like Time Magazine and Missions Magazine. You need to regularly read what is going on. You need to be intelligent about it so that you can talk intelligently and you can be excited about what God is doing in this world today. Talk to missionaries. When you have a missionary, just drain them. Pump them. Pump them hard. Find out what's going on in their country. What are the hindrances to the gospel in their country? What are the needs in their country? I was just talking to the young brother here from Ireland, whose mom and dad are in Tanzania. And his dad said they have found churches that are very similar to the assembly, and they're trying to get out there and just teach. And he said that we've got more work than we can deal with, and we need helpers over here. I wanted to hear that. Because maybe I could be used to direct a young person to go to Tanzania. Get information. Fill your mind like a computer with information. Don't sit there like with a big question mark over your head or sound asleep when people are around. Get information. Be seeking information. Read leading magazines. Read your newspaper. Listen to the news. Listen to the TV. Be an informed Christian. Have a world vision because you've been given a world mandate. All nations. Not America. All nations. That's our goal. And we want the whole world to hear of Jesus Christ. Number two, read the biographies. I believe strongly in this. When I was a teenager of 14 years of age, Mr. Paul Sapp put in my hand a biography that just turned my life around like that. Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret. Changed my whole value system. Changed my whole perspective on faith and living. Couldn't be the same after reading that. I've given out, I don't know how many copies, but many, many copies of Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret. In fact, I just finished reading the 7-volume set by Dr. Broomhall on China in the Open Century. Oh, this is a massive magnum opus. There's nothing else like it. The 7 volumes on China and Hudson Taylor. Boy, have I been blessed by those volumes. And there's nothing in the way of history or missionary biography that even can compare to Broomhall's China and the Open Century. Read biographies. Get biographies into the hands of young people. My one daughter just finished reading Dr. Hamilton's story of how she went to China and helped with the gospel there. And it really touched. She mentioned to me 4 or 5 times now after reading it. Dan, that really touched me. Well, boy, you get a hold of some teenagers and you give them some inspiring story. Not just a baseball player or some silly football player hitting his head on other people's helmets. You give them a something to inspire them bigger. Someone with a world vision. I believe in biography. Keep handing them out and put them into the minds of young people. Number three, train your children. Moms, dads, you play a key role here right now. Train your children. Start giving them a world vision when they're young. They won't even know what happens. It'll just happen to them. I find nothing more discouraging when I'm with a group of teenagers, 17, 18, 19, and all they can talk about are cars and girls, or vice versa. They don't talk about cars. Maybe it's sewing and boys. I don't know what girls talk about. I talk to boys more. That's really discouraging. Moms and dads have not talked to them about politics. They've not talked to them about ethics. They've not talked to them really even about spirituality much. And the kids have really not much between this ear and that ear. Now, my girls know that when we get home on Monday night, we're probably going to have a long, long discussion on Russia and what's happened there and what should we have done and what should be done, and we will talk about it. We may even, very often, I'm clipping things out of the newspaper and I read it to them at the supper table. And when important world events, I make them sit down on the TV and watch the evening news so they see what's going on. Since they've been little children, we've been talking about political matters. We've been talking about ethical matters. We've been talking about the Bible and about spirituality. So that their minds are keen now. And whenever we have missionaries by, I have more for my own selfish reasons for my own girls. We recently had a missionary by. In fact, he couldn't come over for dinner, so I said, would you come over later? So he came over later, and one of the first things I do, I always get a map out right away, and I make him show us exactly where he's at. All right, you're right there. You girls see that right there? I didn't know where it was either. Didn't even know that place was there, actually, but here it is. A lot of places in the world that we hardly know anything about. And then we ask some key questions, and the girls are there listening. That's very important for your children. Start now when they're young. Start to talk to them about important matters. Don't just talk to them about little kitty matters. Start where they're at. They make fun at you at first, but challenge their minds. Challenge their vision. I believe in giving young people vision. I was telling some of the couples here that I am so convinced that fifth, sixth, seventh grade, you've got to capture them there. I don't care what you have to do in your assembly. I don't care what money you have to lay out. The time you have to spend, you've got to get those kids at that age. And if you can unite your young people at that age, if you can spiritually challenge them, you'll have them right through high school. If you lose them there, it's just about impossible. And we lost one whole generation, went right through our church. We didn't get them at that age. They never were friends in high school. They didn't care to be with one another. It was a mess for many years. And the parents are still complaining about it. We've got a fantastic high school group right now because we've got them at that junior high level. They're buddies. Even if the youth leader doesn't meet, they meet together and each other. And that's to challenge their minds. Give them that big vision. Show them what Christianity is about. Christianity is big. It's not small. Christianity is not about the end of my nose. It's about the uttermost parts of the world and what God is doing in this world. Train your children. Give them ideas. Talk to them about the news. Read the newspaper to them. Get them to interact with you about world events and the countries of the world. Number four. My time is out. Can I just take another minute or two? Will anyone leave? Okay, put your hand up so we can stone you. I saw that hand back there. She's probably not even a Christian, so don't worry about it. We'll talk to her later. We'll get her up in Don's plane. You and me, Don. That up and down when you get in the storms, we'll change her. Okay, number four. No, I think she's a Christian. All right, your local church should have a clear mission vision. In your local assembly, in fact, let me read a statement by the great Eric Sauer, what he says about the prayer meeting, about vision, if I can find it here. Here it is. Listen to what Eric Sauer says in Arena of Faith. Church prayer and worldwide mission work belong inseparably together. If ever the inward oneness of the prophetic missionary commission, of course, it's a prophetic missionary commission. It's all in the Old Testament. And the general priesthood of the church is evident. It is manifested here. In a sound local church, the priestly prayer for the prophetic proclamation of God's gospel must occupy a large space. Every prayer meeting in the local church should be a time of united practical striving for and cooperation with God's servants on the mission field at home and abroad. And then he lists a bunch of scriptures, most of them from Paul, where Paul turns to the local church. He says, pray for me, pray for the open door, pray for making it clear. And it appears very clearly that Paul saw his success in the gospel, its largeness, its success, its hindrance, directly connected to the prayers of the local churches. Your church should have a missionary vision. I'm not talking about maybe give $25 to this one and $50 to that one, and we have some missionaries out there. Maybe we can put their cards on the wall. But when people are in your church 4, 5, 6 weeks, all of a sudden they're there and they're catching, boy, this church has a vision. They have a real clear focus. Maybe you have Acts 1:8. you know, starting in Jerusalem and Samaria and Judea and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the world, or Matthew 20. There's a clear focus in your church so that when people are there for a while, they catch the spirit and the vision. These people are doing something around the world. And the prayers are focused. They're not these just, does anyone have a prayer request? And of course, no one ever seems to ever have a prayer request until you really just wait for a long while. In our assembly, we have some very clear focuses. We are praying and laboring. The people have given sacrificially to plant churches in Indonesia. We have one of our finest young couples who were brought up in the assembly there in Indonesia. The day they left for Indonesia, to fly the family there, to provide a year to 2 years' rent, which the government requires, to help them with some furniture and a vehicle, the baseline was $20,000. That was just the baseline to get them there. In 2 weeks, without making any kind of great appeal, but just telling our own body, because we're our own family, we're not appealing for money, the chapel, and it wasn't any big rich people, everyone gave very sacrificially. We raised $25,000 in 2 weeks. And they're there in Indonesia. They've targeted their first two cities. They've got the language. And we received a letter last week. Chuck wrote us and said, we met in our first village, and these are all Muslims. 57 people came to our Bible study, and two of them were these city officials. You have to have official authorization to teach the Bible in these cities. And their second city, they have not gotten authorization yet, but they've sent some Indonesians in, and they've started a Bible study. And the goal is to start a church. And he's involved in training young men. Our church has got this focus, and they're loved by the congregation, and people are giving sacrifice, and the prayers mean something. When their prayer letter is faxed in, it just goes out to everyone, and everyone is really interested. A real clear focus is a vision. Some of our young people want to go in the next year, go down there and help. And then in Mexico, we're helping plant churches. We heard from a church that was planted by one of our young couples that the elders are struggling. It's a really excellent church now. And so we put a thing in the bulletin that those brothers in Mexico asked for one of the elders to go down and visit them and just give them some encouragement. Within a week or two, there was enough money. One of our elders who speaks Spanish fluently, they'll be gone when I get back home for 2 weeks. They're going to be down in Mexico just ministering to a church that's already been planted but it's having some struggles. Now the missionaries are gone. So we have this focus. Your church needs a vision, a world vision, and a focus, and it will excite the congregation, will put fuel behind your prayers and behind your giving, and it will lift up your horizon so you're a great commission church looking to the reaches of the world. An opportunity has arisen for us recently that's just incredible. One couple in our church who has been so bold over the years, they're always doing totally insane things. This time they've taken in these people from Ethiopia. Now, they're not from Ethiopia. They're from Eritrea, which is the country. It's been in all the news here that Ethiopia has annexed Eritrea. It's under communist rule. So there's been a revolution now. And Eritrea is going to receive its freedom. Well, these people that these Christians in our church took in, they're Eritreans. And one of the men speaks five languages. He's very intelligent. He's a very honorable man. He's very religious, but he's not saved. They've been coming for 8 months. They never miss a meeting. And you know, I asked them before I left. I said, will you allow me to have a Bible study with you and all your Eritrean friends? And he has all these friends. One of them goes to Washington. He's working with the CIA to give reports, and he's writing up a history of Eritrea because now there's going to be a new country, and I'm sure our country wants to know all about the developments there. So when I get back, my goal is to see some of these people from Eritrea saved. They all want to go back in 3 or 4 years. If they could get saved in our assembly, get trained in our assembly, it wouldn't cost us a dime. They'd go back to their own country, their own language, their own culture, wouldn't have to wait 5 minutes, and they could be witnessing. And they could plant a church. So the opportunity is right on our goal, right on our doorstep. And I've been talking to the elders and the deacons. We've got to not allow this to slip through our hands. It's a tremendous opportunity. Let's be praying. Let's be giving. Let's help them. We just moved them a few weeks ago. We need to stay on this. We need that world vision. It's been given to us. A great, great commission has been given to us to tell the world of Jesus Christ. Would you want to waste your life telling the world anything else? A great work has been done. Do you deny that? Then a great work needs to be proclaimed. Let us proclaim it. Father, we thank you for your work through your Son on Calvary's cross. The redemptive work and the only work that will rescue a lost sinner. There is no other answer. And before, Father, your Son left, this commission was given to us to disciple all nations. Lord, help us to have a great world vision. Help us to keep that vision before us all the time. Protect us, O God, from selfishness. Protect us from smallness, from narrowness, from getting all caught up in our little world. May we have the vision that you have for this world, for God so loved the world. May we see the news through your eyes. May we have your heartbeat for the world. And may we proclaim boldly, Jesus Christ is Lord. To these ends, we must and we need your help. Raise up within us a vision and your heartbeat for the lost. Amen.